Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Collazo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty here on April 4th. Peter, how you doing?
I'm doing great. We're now past the halfway point in the college season, which is insane to believe.
That doesn't feel like it should be real. We always wait so long for the college season to come, and then it just flies right on by us.
I was going to say, it's similar to Christmas, where like you wait for it all year, and then it the actual day itself feels like 10 minutes. It's that magnified. It's like in doing all these what to watch for pieces, and as I title them, I'm like week eight, like we've only got six of these or seven of these left, but really enjoying it. And from a draft standpoint, things are only going to get hotter and hotter, so lots to dive into as always.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a busy week on the site with draft content. We had a staff draft released today as we record this episode. We're going to talk through that a little bit on the podcast. I had check-ins with each of the top 30 players on our draft board currently. Peter, you dropped the hammer on us, and you have a 2026 college draft prospect board that landed on the site today as well. So there's a ton of stuff to keep you occupied if you want to maybe not do some work on this Friday as you're listening to this podcast. But how does it feel, I guess, first of all, to get that new draft ranking out for the 26 class? Right now we have rankings for each of the next three draft classes in some capacity. Ben has his 2026 high school class list out. We have 2025s for both the high school and the college. And obviously we have the running top 300 draft board for the 24s. So if you are a super draft nerd, and again, if you're listening to this podcast, it's probably the case, you can be up to speed and ahead of the game on all the names you probably need to know at this stage for this year, for next year, and for the year after that.
Yeah, it feels good getting it out. Again, at this stage, the cycle hasn't even begun and isn't really even close to beginning, but we've got enough of a sample size under our belts where we can kind of sort out who the top performers are, obviously, to this point, and then also who's come out and looked like a legit prospect, a legit dude. So it was more about getting the right names on there and then sorting through them as best I can. But As you know, with all of the 200, 300, it felt good just getting it out there and allowing the people to have access to what I hope and think are pretty detailed and thorough reports. So
yeah,
good to get it out there. And like you said, we've now got draft rankings for every class that's in college right now, and then all the way down through high school sophomores. So pretty good stuff.
Yeah, and I don't think we'll ever really expand beyond that. I don't think we have really a desire to rank high school freshmen or rank. So I think this is kind of the furthest out into the future we'll go. Like you said, in a draft ranking, when you're looking this far out, it really is more of a case of like trying to assemble the right names. And really, I think just starting your histories on a player as early as possible, so your feel for these players as they continue to play in college and matriculate up to their actual draft year, you just have more comfort with the profile, more of a history on the player. And if we can allow our readers to have that as well, I think that's a positive thing. Because if you even just look at 2024's draft list, the amount of change that happens with that board from January of this year, the current draft year, to July, it's a significant amount of change. So there'll be plenty of moving parts on that board throughout the years, but it's nice to have it up now and kind of take a sneak peek at what's on the horizon for the draft class. We had some news this week that came out. Typically around this time of year is when the bonus pools are announced. Peter, I'm not sure how much you get excited for this, but I'm always intrigued to see the actual figures come out. You get a general sense of who's going to have a lot of pool money just based on the picks, who has supplemental picks, who has the new PPI picks, where teams are going to be drafting in subsequent rounds. All of that adds up, and you can make a pretty informed guess. But the actual slot values coming out, I always think is fun. It's nice to see and just imagine like what teams could do strategically with their bonus pool. Those were dropped. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, just really quickly. Cleveland obviously has the biggest bonus pool at $18.3 million after getting the first overall pick. And the slot value that comes with 1-1 is $10.5 million, which is a million, like $1.3 million more than Paul Skeens' record-setting signing bonus from a year ago when he was 1-1. That bonus that he signed was significantly under slot for that pick. I think it was around $500,000 under slot. I can't imagine in this draft class there's going to be anyone that comes close to a $10 million deal, just given sort of the where that top group of players in 23 was at compared to how the industry views the top of the class group this year. And so if you factor in Cleveland's ability to get to 19 million plus by hitting the 5% overage, which they did last year, they've got a ton of money. If they take a big haircut with the first overall pick, they're going to be able to do a lot of damage with subsequent picks. They've taken that sort of portfolio approach in the past. But yeah, thoughts on just the bonus pools being announced, any teams you're intrigued about, or any thoughts on the fact that we have really three picks that have a $9 million value on them and only two players in history have signed for $9 million or more. And that's Skeens and Dylan Cruz from last year.
Yeah. I think when it comes out every year, I think myself, along with the vast majority of people, I kind of go to see what the 1-1 slot value is. I was pretty blown away to see it above 10 this year. And I'm with you that no one is going to come relatively close to getting a $10 million bonus. Like, for as good as guys like Travis Bazzana and Charlie Connan have been, even for as big a Bazzana guy as I am, if I'm Cleveland, I'm not really going to even consider giving either of them the full slot value. So I'm curious to see how much of a haircut there really is at one, and if we can, you know, if they get creative, if someone like a Braden Montgomery goes there, or you know, anyone else. But I think I also was intrigued with Arizona at 12-6. They have one of the PPI picks.
Yeah.
Baltimore as well at 10-9. They also have a PPI pick. And so I'm kind of curious to see how they divvy up that money. I know last year we saw Seattle. They went with the three pretty highly touted prep guys in that late 20s, early 30s range. So I'm curious to see what the D-backs and Orioles do respectively with that pool money.
Yeah, I think the Diamondbacks are maybe the most fascinating team once you get outside of the top five, top 10 range. They have, like you said, $12.6 million in bonus pool money. That's more than any team picking in the 18 to 30 range. So really in the back third of the first round, it's weird to say this because they're picking at 29, but it almost feels like they're in a bit of a driver's seat, at least in terms of flexibility and creativity. They can used to maneuver the draft. They're there. Like, there will undoubtedly be some college players that maybe they'll be interested in who will simply get picked before them. It's a lot harder to slide a college player down the board just given the leverage games that you're able to play from the player and the agent side there. But the fact that they have so much more money, I mean, Houston picking right in front of them, they have a $5.9 million pool. Philly picking two spots in front, they have a $7.3 million pool. The Yankees at 8.1, the Padres at 9.3, and right behind them, Texas with 6.9. I mean, they've got twice as much money as Houston in front of them and significantly more overall than really all the teams picking in the back of the first. They have the 31st overall pick that comes with a $2.9 million slot value. That's the PPI pick from Corbin Carroll. Then you only have to wait a few more picks at 35 overall before you get to their supplemental first-round pick that has a $2.6 million slot value. And we've seen Arizona, they're a team that typically has these extra picks. I believe it was the Blake Walston draft a few years ago, where they had a number of picks in this sort of range. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do. The way the draft class is shaping up right now, it feels like once we get in the really around 10 to 12 range, there's a pretty solid tier break. And then I feel like there's not a ton of separation with players. Now, again, maybe that'll change between now and draft day, but they're really well positioned, kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm looking at St. Louis picking 7th overall. They just have $10 million in bonus pool money. That is the lowest amount of any team picking top 12. So maybe they're in a situation where they have relatively little leverage compared to the teams around them. How that'll affect how they're able to maybe navigate the board or maneuver some players to that spot. Do they take a strategy where they try and save money there to spread their thin pool out? They don't have a second round pick. They don't have any supplemental round picks because it's St. Louis. They never do. So that'll be interesting. But again, like we've seen the Rangers in this scenario where they have a first round pick. Just last year, the Rangers were picking fourth overall. They didn't have a few picks, I think, until the fourth round. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one. But they also decided to go over slot and get Wyatt Langford fourth overall. And maybe you think that's inherently risky because you already have less pool money than all the teams picking in this range. You go over slot with your first, and you really have to cut a lot of money later on. But they've done that. I think that worked out well for them. So St. Louis and Arizona, I think strategically and just thinking through the financials of the MLB draft system will be maybe two of the more interesting teams for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on both of that. And I think when the bonus pool money is announced, like it's very fun, just as we've kind of dived into a little bit here. We could go a lot more in depth, but in trying to project on what each respective team strategy is, and you start looking at the names and you just kind of start darting down the board as to, you know, who could fit where, who could fit as an overslot guy, like you mentioned, like a Langford, or, you know, who could be bought down and sign under slot. So it's another piece of the puzzle and what makes this thing so much fun.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting too, just thinking about Cleveland and Cincinnati 1-2, because Cleveland, and again, I do think it's probably a bit of a different calculus when you're picking at the very top 1 and 2 compared to where Cleveland and Cincinnati have been, maybe more middle or back of the first round, how that changes your strategy. But Cleveland has pretty consistently been a team that is cutting with their first pick, saving some of that money for their second pick. The last few drafts, they've had sort of package deals where their top two players, you're getting an underslot and then an overslot and kind of getting similar talents, I would say, with the first two overall picks. That seems to be a consistent strategy with them, whereas Cincinnati for a few years now has been willing to go for overslot deals in the first round to get a player they really like. I believe Cam Collier was one of those. Matt McLean was another where they went overslot to kind of get a player down the board. So that dynamic of them picking 1-2, if they maintain those strategies, how does that impact the top of the draft discussion? If we're still on draft day are winding up with a class at the top that's really muddled and there are a number of players that fit for the 1-1 overall pick, I think that could get interesting really quickly, because it wouldn't shock me if on draft day both these players wound up with the exact players they wanted, despite the fact that one's picking after another just based on draft strategy and how they choose to navigate the board. So that's always fun. I mean, in general this year, I would expect a lot of underslot deals in the first round. That's typically the case. I believe last year there were 12 deals in the first round that were either at slot or around slot and above. Everything else was an underslot deal. So for the most part, this is how teams operate. And this is an 8.7% increase in slot values overall. I'm not sure how the industry thinks about the talent being 8.7% better than a year ago, how that factors in. So
I think I have a feeling, but for Cleveland, I think it's all going to come down to, like, obviously the talent is the main factor here, but I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to who is willing to take the biggest haircut up at the mm-hmm. top. And so that's where I kind of think it could get a little interesting at 1-1, because Connan and Bazzana, I think right now are like that tier of 10 or so guys, 8 to 10 or so guys that still exist. And then that's tier 1A might even be Connan and Bazzana at this point, but Caglione is obviously still in the mix. I don't know where he'll end up. Braden Montgomery has kind of thrust himself in there. Hagen Smith, similarly, I'm curious to see how JJ Weatherholt looks when he comes back. So there are a lot of factors at play for Cleveland picking first, and it's not as easy as it might seem on the surface. So I think it could go a lot of different ways.
Yeah, it's reminding me right now, just in terms of how the class maybe is shaping up and the strategies of the team picking 1-1, or at least what we've seen to be their strategy in previous years, but of the Pirates picking 1-1 in 2021, that 2021 class had a fairly muddled top of the draft. They wound up saving a bunch of money with Henry Davis in that 1-1 slot, then took guys like Anthony Solomito, Lonnie White, Bubba Chandler for significant overslot deals with subsequent picks. And that strategy, I feel like, aligns a lot with how I think of what Cleveland could do. They're a team that has been willing to invest in high school pitching, so maybe that's a demographic that you feel like you can put some more money towards later in this draft. I do think that one of the strengths of this draft class is the high school pitching depth. When you get away from the top of the board, there are a lot of arms that I feel like fit nicely in this kind of second, third, fourth round range that maybe you could be intrigued with. You take your college player up top that you feel reasonably confident in, save some money there just based on the valuation of the slot. And maybe, again, if it's muddled and there's no clear 1-1, you just kind of find the guy that's going to take the best deal. I don't typically love that strategy, but I think there's a lot of logic to it. I
don't think that like they should get super, super cute at one. Like, I think they just got to get their guy and like not be deal hunting at like at 1-1. Mm. But anyways, carry on.
Yeah, but it's just interesting to think about. Like, I would be completely unsurprised if their draft class in 24 looks similar, at least in terms of the strategy they use to work down the board to Pittsburgh's in 2021. So that'll be interesting. Really quickly, the bottom five teams in total bonus pool. Houston is at the very bottom, picking 28. The Dodgers at 23 have just 6.1 million. Texas at 30 has 6.9 million. Philly at 27 has 7.3 million. And then the Giants, maybe another team we should mention just briefly here. They have the fifth lowest bonus pool in the class at 7.56 million, and they're picking 13. So that'd be another team that's towards the top, but really in terms of overall money they have to work with, they're going to be out-muscled by the teams around them. So maybe that could be an interesting team to watch on draft day as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm with you.
Cool. All right. Well, that's enough money and pool, slot value, bonus pool, nerd conversation for today. We can get into some more maybe fun things. I guess let's get into our staff draft, Peter, because you had the 1-1 pick. You had the Guardians in this situation. We like to do staff drafts throughout draft season just to, honestly, because people love drafts and it's hard to manufacture a mock draft relentlessly this far out. And also we just like talking through the class and thinking about the players and how I view a player versus how you or Jeff or Ben or JJ views a player, I think is instructive for me at least. And so it was fun to do this exercise. We went picks 1 through 39, taking us through the full supplemental first round. You picked first, I picked fifth. We did a random ordering for that. And I wound up with one fewer pick overall and the fifth overall. But take me through your process for 1-1 in this staff draft we did.
I'm sure like no one was like, definitely you. I don't think you were pretty shocked with who I ended up taking. I knew if I had the first overall pick who I was going with. It was an easy Travis Bezzana for me. Not super easy. Like I thought about Condon here. But I jumped on Bezzana. I think he's the top college player in the class. He's an elite level athlete, explosive bat speed. He's got a clear plus hit tool. He's seen a real power jump this year. It's plus to the pull side. I'd probably give it a 55 overall. And he can just impact the game in so many ways. And I think, and this is the kind of upside you're looking for here at 1-1. I think he's got multi-time all-star type upside as a big leaguer. So I've been really convicted on him for a couple of years now, and I was just going to stick with my guy here.
Yeah, absolutely. So Travis Bezzana, 1-1. I know there are a lot of Guardians fans on Twitter that I see who really like Bezzana. It feels like there is a Bezzana versus Charlie Condon. And even I've seen some Braden Montgomery love for Guardians fans on Twitter. So that one is fun. Jeff at picking 2, it's not a shocking pick, but I think it's a little bit surprising. Maybe not knowing Jeff's preferences for players, but just overall, he took Hagen Smith in the 2 spot for the Reds. That left Charlie Condon as the, I think, fairly easy pick for JJ, picking number 3. Ben takes JJ Weatherholt, number 4. Still pretty high on just his pure hitting ability, despite the fact that he's been out for most of the season. And that left me at five with kind of a difficult choice, I thought. I kind of expected Chase Burns to go in one of the first four picks in front of me. I think Weatherholt was maybe the player I wasn't anticipating in front. So I was debating between Braden Montgomery, Chase Burns, and Jack Caglione in this five spot for the White Sox. Ultimately, I went with Braden Montgomery because I had the most conviction in the hit-power combo. I really like his profile in right field. There are, I guess, some risk factors with both Burns and Caglione that maybe steered me more towards Montgomery, but I think either would have been a fine pick at five. So what are your thoughts on how the top five panned out there that I just rolled through?
Yeah, the first surprise was Hagen Smith at two. I thought Jeff was going to snatch up Charlie Condon pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But the fun part of doing these staff drafts, and it's more of like a, it's almost more of a fantasy style draft. Like, yes, the names are attached to organizations, but it's not a mock whatsoever. So it's kind of like a fantasy draft essentially. And, Jeff always says,
just to make it clear, like this process is not us trying to intuit or project who the teams might take. It's simply who would we take if we were given the keys to the selection for each of these picks. So read into that as much or as little you want, as you're kind of going down this board. I think it's more useful just to think about it as like, these are the players who feel like are in the range for the actual draft. And then the actual picks maybe tell you more about the preferences of the individual writers.
Exactly. No, at two, I was a little surprised, but Jeff always makes these a ton of fun with a couple or a handful of somewhat surprising picks. And then afterwards, I wasn't totally shocked to see Weatherholt go four. I was somewhat expecting Montgomery to have maybe played his way into that top quartet. And then for me at six, I was just going to take whoever didn't go between Montgomery and Burns. Gotcha. I was hoping Montgomery would make it to me. He's a guy that I've fallen more and more in love with as the season goes on. You've mentioned it. It's an ever-developing and progressing hit tool with plus power from both sides of the plate, a 70-grade arm in right field. He's a good athlete. He's explosive in the box. There's a lot to like. So I think he's kind of played his way into that top five range, maybe even a little bit higher.
Yep.
And then with Burns, for me, I went with the next best pitcher, at least on the board, outside of Hagen Smith. 270s in his premium fastball, hellacious slider, has also shown flashes of a potentially plus curveball. The command and control have both progressed well since moving to Wake. And I'm a lot less worried now than I was this time last year that he would end up in a bullpen one day. And he's got apparent front of the rotation upside. So I snagged him here. I was also considering Caglione, but again, for me, it's like, I hate to harp on this narrative and it might be a harsh one that two-way players don't exist, but like, I say it somewhat facetiously, but prove me otherwise outside of Ohtani, like they're show me an impact two-way guy at the big league level. And that's not to say Jack Caglione isn't an incredible talent. He's a one of a kind talent, but am I going to take Jack Caglione's bat or Jack Caglione's arm sixth overall? Like, probably not. Again, he's going to go in the top 10, all but certainly. But I wasn't ready to pull the trigger on it at six.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. As you mentioned, I don't know if we did actually mention it, but Jeff did take Jack Caglione with the pick right after you at seven. For Jeff, it looked like he thought Cags was kind of the last of this top tier. One of the few Jeff picks where it will be kind of a value pick and a straight off the board pick, because I think, like you mentioned, Jeff is probably the least tied to the board as we have it, which I think is nice. We get a great difference in opinion with a lot of Jeff's picks. And when he likes a guy, he's really not afraid to pop them where he wants to get him. So I appreciate that. At eight, I think actually this is maybe the biggest surprise pick for me of the draft. JJ selecting for the Angels took Jonathan Santucci.
Yeah.
Left-hander at Duke. I think 3 weeks ago, this pick wouldn't have fazed me too much, but Santucci has stumbled a bit in conference play, hasn't been quite as sharp as he was in the first 3 weeks of the season. There are some, I would say, even stronger control questions that I would have with Santucci at this point. I don't think it's a crazy reach. He is left-handed. He has solid stuff. I like the body. So there are things to like, but JJ goes to Jonathan Santucci. Ben, again, takes a player who I don't know if we can say they're sliding, but Ben is not afraid to take a player that he likes the hitting ability with, despite maybe some health and performance questions. So he goes with Nick Kurtz at Wake Forest, and that left me in a bit of a pickle at 10. I was really hoping Kurtz would fall to me. I love Nick Kurtz, and I was encouraged with his at-bats, even when he wasn't putting up the back of the baseball card numbers when I saw him. I would have been thrilled to get him at 10 overall. I think that would have been a steal. So instead, I had to go for the first high school player in the class at number 10 for the Nationals and take Connor Griffin. Just sizing up the board at this stage and looking at my other options, almost all college players, I think we're getting into the range where there are real questions with profiles. And so I'll just take the guy that I think probably has the biggest pure upside available in this range. And I think that's a profile that the Nationals in the past, I actually think makes sense for them. I'll be curious to see if their draft strategy changes this year with some new people in the scouting room.
Yeah, I'm with you on Santucci being a little bit of a surprising pick. It's unfortunate, literally, since I talked him up so glowingly leading up to
We talked about how quickly things can change, and this is like evidence of that.
Oh, exactly. No, like if we did this staff draft that week, like, and I was picking in that 8 range, he absolutely would have been a name I kicked around. But I'm with you. The command and control haven't been as sharp. He hasn't been as sharp in general. Like, the stuff is still really impressive. The fastball and slider are both plus. I think the changeup is above average, and you got an athletic left-hander. I do think, though, the overall pitchability is a little bit more of an issue than it was for me even just a few weeks ago and seeing it. I know it was a little bit of an issue last year, but he had seemed to kind of turn a corner a little bit. So, and seeing how the board played out and in looking at it, like after Jeff took Caglione at 7, like, and who knows how much of a reflection this is going to be of draft night. Like, you can go so many different ways. So when it got to me at 11.
Yeah. Do you feel like the tier break is once these top 7 players come off the board? Do you think Weatherholt, would you include Weatherholt and or Nick Kurtz in that still? So for me, I would view it as an 8 player tier, including Kurtz and Weatherholt, with all the players who went top 7. What do you view it as?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'd probably still include Kurtz in that tier. Like, I think he's probably, for me, the last name in there. But I think it'd be hard to not include him altogether. And yeah. So I think you can call it an eight player tier. And then after that, though, I think it certainly falls off. Like, for me, with Connor Griffin, he's an absolute tool shed. But for me, like, in that range, 8 to 10, like, that's someone you've got to really, really love and be bought in on all the tools and the upside to pull the trigger on and pay him that kind of money. I personally wouldn't be there. I feel like a team in that range will be there, but for me, I wouldn't be. And that's not a knock on Griffin. Like, he's far and away, for me at least, the best high school player in the class. He's got some of the highest upside of any player in the class. I'm just not super convicted on it yet. At least in that range. Like, I'm not convicted on it in that range. So I went with Loma Vita. For me, he's the best catcher in the class. He's currently in the midst of what's looking like a career year at Cal. It's plus power to the pull side. He's a really good athlete behind the plate. He receives well. He's got an above average arm. There, to me, is very little concern that he's going to be able to stick at the catching position long term. He's got a good feel for the barrel. He's consistently on it. It's plus raw power. He's got plus bat speed. He's a thick physical kid, but he runs really well for a catcher. And he's kind of found a happy medium between what used to be a really high leg kick. He's quieted it down some. And I think the overall tool set is really enticing. You've got a lengthy track record of performance, both at the college level and with a wood bat. He's a 2-time Cape League All-Star. He flashed the power with wood. performed at a really high level against some of the best pitching in the country. I think it's a combination of a somewhat safe pick and then also a little bit of an upside pick. Like, I think he's got the ability to be a potentially impact big leaguer. And for a catcher to have the kind of tools that he does, I think it's a really fun and appealing package. So
yeah,
11 might have been a little bit of a reach, but in looking down the board, there's not some, like, maybe my next pick actually, or sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's not someone like screaming that obviously needs to be taken in this range. So I think he does fit in sort of this like 10 to 15 range for me, just given the tool set, given the profile, given the production. I have some hesitancy with the approach. It is a pretty aggressive approach. He's walking just 3.3% of the time. The walk rate has trended down throughout his career, but it's also hard to knock that too much when the production has just improved consistently. And when he's hitting like this, I mean, maybe you're just so locked in, you really don't want to take a walk, but I do think there is maybe some refinement in the approach that'll be necessary in pro ball.
Yeah.
But again, all the tools you mentioned, the athleticism, the high probability of sticking at catcher, I think are make him a solid target in this range.
Yeah, I'm with you at the one wart to me, and it's a kind of an apparent one, and it hasn't hindered his production so much. It is the approach, specifically right on right breaking balls. He'll expand the zone a little bit and has the tendency to. But like you said, where it hasn't held him back some, it's that's the only concern for me. But nonetheless, a really exciting set of tools.
Yeah, moving down the board further, Jeff next took Cam Smith at Florida State. He's continued to show an improved approach. JJ goes with Vance Honeycutt, the tool shed outfielder out of North Carolina. Ben, maybe with the next surprising pick of the draft, but after he made it, I was like, you know what, that makes a lot of sense, I think. I just, in my mind, wasn't thinking about this player there, but Treya Savage, right-handed pitcher out of ECU to the Cubs. I think Ben makes a pretty compelling case that his stuff stacks up with some of the top college arms in the draft. He's got a deep pitch mix with quality secondaries. He's thrown a lot of strikes. He's performed. So after he made the pick, I was like, yeah, there's really no reason why he doesn't fit in this range, but I didn't expect him at 14. How about you?
Yeah, I'm with you that in after seeing him make the pick, I was like, okay, you know, that's not too outlandish a pick. Seeing him go before someone like a Brody Brecht was a little bit surprising. Even maybe one of the prep arms that you or I took was also somewhat surprising, especially where Ben seems to be a little like prep heavy in here too. But I like the pick. I like you Savage a lot. And I think I don't know if he ends up going in the top half of the first round, but I think he's pretty comfortably in that like 18 to 25 or so range.
Yeah. And next pick for me at 15, picking for the Mariners. I was looking around the board and there wasn't like, I prefer to probably take a college player here if there's one that made a lot of sense, but I really didn't have one that I was falling in love with. I thought about Kalen Culpepper here because he's one of the few shortstop profiles. But other than that, like I didn't really have a great feel for what I wanted here. So I went with a demographic that I typically like in Bryce Rayner, high school shortstop, really loud tools, big raw power, projectable frame, room to add more in the future, easy 70 arm that should keep him on the left side of the infield somewhere. Even if he has to move off shortstop, I think he probably will grow into enough pop to profile nicely at third base. Again, we've talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast. I really like him on the mound. It sounds like he prefers hitting. It sounds like he's gotten really good reviews as a hitter and as a shortstop this spring. So I would happily take him, let him hit until he proved that he couldn't. And then you've got a nice right-handed pitching fallback option as well. So that was my thought process with 15. And this is now getting into the back half of the first round with your pick at 16, Peter.
Yeah, I thought that was a good pick at 15, especially with the progress he's made with the bat this spring and what the reviews have been like. So I like that one. I snagged William Schmidt. For me, it's the clear cut best prep arm in the class. And I think when all is said and done, he's going to end up going before pick number 16.
Potentially. I'll be very intrigued where he goes because I do think the class is down, but I also think just the gravity that happens to the high school right-hander demographic always feels like they go lower than they should on draft day. I mean, just last year we had only Noblemeyer. Again, it's not really an apples to apples comparison because those classes, the makeup and the strength of the college demographic is just so different. But yeah, it will be intriguing. And also, I think it was after you made this pick, he threw in a game and touched 99. So he's been up to 98, 99 this spring and has looked really electric.
Oh, there we go. Well, my caps on him's already outdated then, because I said he's up to 98. But no, with him, it really good body with projection remaining. He moves super well on the mound. He's a good athlete, tons of arm speed. The calling card with him is obviously the high 70s hammer breaking ball. It's a really sharp downer curve ball with tons of depth, up to and even eclipsing 3,000 RPMs of spin rate. It's a comfortably plus pitch. And like you said, he pairs it with a lively mid to upper 90s now fastball, a pitch that's taken a step forward in the velo department. So I really like the overall package that Schmidt has. And I think, like you said, where the waters kind of get muddied after that group of seven, and it's kind of looking like now it could go in a number of different directions. I'm not really sure how high he could end up going. So he's certainly one guy I've pegged like down in this range as a prime guy to follow who could kind of keep on creeping up.
And clearly the Marlins are an organization that would not shy away from a high school pitcher demographic after taking both Noblemeyer and Thomas White a year ago. So that one makes sense just from that perspective as well.
I was going to say, even if it were a mock, it would have worked out well. So
at 17 for the Brewers, Jeff takes Brody Brecht, which feels like the most Jeff pick ever. He has stuff, real strikes questions. Basically for me, feels like a similar profile. The industry still seems super high. You had mentioned him earlier as a name that maybe you thought of before Trey Savage. It wouldn't surprise me if he went before this pick, just given the prodigious arm talent that he has. JJ at 18 took Kalen Culpepper. I think he liked just what he perceived as the relative safety of the profile. And then Ben, with another banger of a pick at 19, takes a guy in PJ Morlando, who he has a long track record of watching him just rake and hit for power. This maybe is another kind of surprising pick for me. Maybe not as surprising, just knowing Ben's preferences and tendencies and willingness to stick with hitters that he really likes. Like I think a year ago, Ben would have taken Kevin McGonigal top 15, despite the fact that the industry had him going a little bit further down the board than that. And here Ben is again taking a guy like Morlando, who might be sliding down our board. I think we have him in the back third of the first round. Some people don't think of him as a first rounder. But there is no doubt that if you want a pure hitter in the high school class, Morlando is close to as good as it gets this year. So that was Ben's pick at 19. At 20, I was happy this player was still on the board. I might be just higher on this player than everyone else operating in this draft, but I took Jacob Cozart at NC State. I don't think that, for me, I know you like Caleb Lomavita. I think there could be a case to be made that Cozart is the best catcher in this draft class. He's performed really well at State so far this spring, continues to improve as a hitter. It's a nice patience and power combination. He's a little bit big for your typical catcher, but I actually think he receives and throws well behind the dish. I was really impressed with him last summer with Team USA. So in terms of the player's talent, in terms of the demographic as a left-handed hitting college catcher, I really like the value here at 20 in what I see as like maybe a down group of bats in this range this year. So that's 15 through 20. Any thoughts, Peter?
Yeah, I won for Cozart at 20. I think that's a perfectly acceptable and solid range for him. Brecht at 17, I thought was a really good get in that range, and the arm talent for Brody. Kalen Culpepper at 18, I think that reflects where he's probably going to end up in the range, at least in which he's going to end up being popped this July. Morlando, personally, I know he's a little bit polarizing, and I know he's also a little bit of a cheese ball for Ben. I don't know. I wouldn't take him at 19. I have like my own personal range in which I'd take him. It wouldn't have been that early. Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting into the range where there are going to be some players on the board where the opinions throughout the industry and even within our 5-person staff here doing this draft vary wildly. So it kind of just is wide open at this point. So,
oh, exactly. I think that's like, that's what's going to make draft night. So it's just going to make it a ton of fun, I think, and fascinating to follow, because I think there are so many names that you could see, you know, get thrown around in this range.
Absolutely. And then, so the guy that I was considering at 20 and didn't take, you took him with your next pick, and I feel like that's going to be a theme of our picks back and forth throughout the rest of the draft here, Peter.
Grabbing King at 21, for me, it was a no-brainer. I have my concerns a little bit about his approach, particularly picking up spin out of the hands and out of the hand and pitch recognition skills, but he's such an explosive athlete, thunderous bat speed. He spent a little bit of time on the dirt this spring. I think ultimately the athleticism and actions coupled with his double plus speed, that all I think fits best in center field. So while the hit tool needs refining, it's such a loud and explosive set of tools with a pretty solid track record of performance as well. I know he hasn't necessarily lived up to the hype so far at Wake, but he's still producing at a relatively solid clip. And then you go back to his summer on the Cape and Team USA, where he hit well and showed really well. So I think getting him at 21, I was really happy about it.
Yeah, it feels like good value. It feels surprising that King lasted that long. I mean, I was part of the reason he lasted that long, passing him at 20 in the first place. But I thought for sure
you were going to snag him at 20.
I do like Cozart as well, though, and just the fact that he has been performing and I have less questions about his approach and maybe even just the defensive profile. Cozart felt safer to me, whereas King is the more exciting pick in this range and the player that you can more easily dream on. So I don't doubt it at all. I went back and forth a little bit there. So at 22, Jeff takes Theo Gillen, which is the furthest off the board pick right now. But I think Jeff is tapping into the fact that Gillen has continued to impress and perform and hit in Texas. He's a shortstop out of Westlake High School in Austin, Texas, who has a pretty long track record and history of hitting well. He takes him at 22 for the Orioles. JJ goes with Luke Holman, right-handed pitcher at LSU at 23. Ben goes for another high school player in Cam Caminiti for the Braves at 24. And that left me with Billy Amick kind of falling in my lap at 25. I thought once we got into sort of the late teens, Amick would be a player who was targeted, and I really did not expect him to be on the board here at 25. Again, we haven't had a significant amount of college hitters going in this 15 to 25 range. But I'm more than happy to get a guy in Amick who I think has tremendous bat speed, a lot of raw power, has performed well and looked better than expected at third base. And then Peter, to you at 26.
I was so bummed when you snagged Amick at 25. And like you said, going back all the way into the 20 to 21 range, even 15 and 16 with Rainer, it was like a battle between you and I of you snagging like a guy, but right.
It also makes it interesting because I have a pretty good sense of the players that you really like. And I feel like I have a good idea of where you want them just because every week we're talking about these players. And so like, I'm like, well, if I don't take this player here, I feel really confident Peter's going to take him. So if I want him, I need to grab him. And I guess the turn for me is more advantageous, after you make your 1-1 pick, obviously.
Well, you were on the money with a few of these guys. Amick, I was ready to pounce on him. You took him, but I took another one of kind of a guy that personally I really like a lot. I went a little bit down the board to 36 to get him. I also feel like
36 on the board for 26 overall, like in this range, that really doesn't feel like an off the board pick for me.
Right. It is going down numbers wise, but especially like in looking at the nature of the class and how it's all going to unfold, it's really not too much of a, it's really not a reach at all.
It's so hard to separate guys in this range. So that numerical difference definitely overstates the actual like talent gap that we perceive. And I imagine the industry perceives as well.
Oh, 1000%. So I snagged Benj. I really like him a lot. And I know that the back of the baseball card for him right now isn't super, super loud and not as loud as some of the other guys in this range, namely Billy Amick. But there's a lot to like. It's a little bit of a noisy operation with a big time barrel kick and a big time barrel tip and a leg kick. But he's got thunderous hand speed, barrel really exposed through the zone. Borderline plus power, I think, to the pull side with an advanced field of hit. And he's a really good athlete. He runs well. He's got a plus arm in the outfield with a pretty fairly advanced baseball sense. Defensively, I'm kind of curious to see, and I know it's a point I've brought up before, if he's able to get a chance to show himself and in center field at all, because I think that the athleticism, arm, and instincts would all translate pretty well to the position. But worst case, he's going to stick in right and be able to play quality right field. And I think the cherry on top with him is he really loves to play. You can kind of see it in his style of play. So just a guy that's really fun to watch. I like the tools. And yeah, I think he's I think he's someone that ends up in that 25 to like 36 to 40 or so range when all said and done.
Yeah. All right. And then we'll just go through the first 30 picks here on the podcast. We've got nine more. Beyond that, that you can see with our full staff draft on the site. At 27, Jeff went with Slade Caldwell, who is one of the better pure hitters, better performers, up the middle profile. I think fits in this range as well. JJ and Ben then continued taking sort of these like post-hype hitters who maybe have not lived up to expectations so far, and Tommy White at 28 for JJ, and Mike Sirota at 29 for the D-backs for Ben. Ben's draft really is a lot of these like post-hype hitters who he very much is still in on and potentially getting really good value if they are just kind of having a down first few weeks of the season. Cause he's taking guys like Weatherholt, who hasn't played, Nick Kurtz, who's not performed and dealt with injury, PJ Morlando, who's been down arrow, and now Mike Sirota, who has had a pretty cool start to the season, has not shown much power after homering 16 or maybe 18 times last year. Pretty big homer spike for him in his sophomore season. Really needs to get a little bit hotter to maintain the sort of draft stock he had entering the year, but he's getting him here at 29. So I don't think that is a terrible pick. I think given his overall tool set, contact ability, approach at the plate, like it tracks for players Ben likes. It actually tracks for players the D-backs have liked in the past. And I think it makes sense for 29. At 30 for me, again, I'm just taking a demographic that I really like because I don't think there are a ton of these players in the class. I'm going with a high school shortstop. That's Kellen Lindsay. It's weird. It's a player that I haven't seen much at all, and I haven't seen him in person, but it's hard to shake how loud the scout feedback has been of Lindsay. Top of the scale runner, really improved defensive actions at shortstop, bat to ball skills. So I feel like given the other options available here at 30, that's a profile that I'd be willing to bet on. So that kind of takes us through the first round. Peter, any thoughts on players who didn't go, any picks, your favorite picks of the draft, guys you really regret not taking, anything like that?
My favorite pick in that range is probably Jeff with Slade Caldwell at 27. Yeah. To keep it simple on Caldwell, I mean, he's just a damn good baseball player. And I really liked getting him. He was someone that I kicked around a little bit and considered at 26. So I like that one at 27 for Jeff. And then someone who I took at 36, James Tibbs. I was close to taking him at very close to taking him at 26. And even kicked him around briefly at 21, but I had to go with Seaver King.
Yeah, I also really thought hard about taking Tibbs at 35. I went with Christian Moore there at Tennessee, but I was pretty confident you were going to be taking Tibbs there at 36 with him being on the board still and that being your last pick of the draft. So
yes.
Get any points for knowing what people picking around you are going to do, I would feel good about my performance though.
I was going to say you far and away would have had the most,
but for actual players, check back in 5 years and we'll see.
Exactly. No, but it was a ton of fun to do. I think that there are some picks too that we didn't discuss that were really intriguing and I liked a lot. So the rest of it is over on the site and all of our rationale is on the site that you can go ahead and read, but it was a lot of fun to do. I really like doing these. It's such a fun exercise, as we had already said. So it was a blast as always.
Yeah. I mean, just cosplaying as scouting directors, if teams are foolish enough to let us make picks is always a lot of fun. So let us know what you think about our drafts. Which pool of players from each writer do you prefer? Did you like the best? Were there any players we didn't take that you thought we should have? Definitely let us know what you thought about it. What do you think of the class at this point? Peter, before we get out of here, curious if you have any players that you want to talk about or an early preview of the 2026 draft board you just launched. Again, I would encourage everyone to go and read all of your reports to get more in-depth information on kind of how these players are looking now. But if you have any strong thoughts or or opinions or a specific player or two you want to mention here, by all means, please do.
Yeah, the full rankings and subsequent reports are all over on the site. But 1-1 in the not even 1-1 in the class. The top ranked player in the class right now is probably unsurprisingly to anyone listening, Drew Burris, outfielder out of Georgia Tech. He's got a really impressive set of tools packed into his compact 5'9" frame. He's off to a torrid start at the plate. He's a really good athlete with a plus arm in the field. He runs well. He's got big time bat speed with comfortably plus power, consistently on the barrel. The plate coverage he has with power is impressive for anyone, let alone a freshman. And he's also got a sound approach to go with it. He seldom expands the strike zone. He right now, I think, is the clear best freshman in the country. There are a lot of other guys who have performed well to this point. And are intriguing prospects with a very high-end set of tools. But for me, Burris is that clear guy at number one. And then after that, there are a lot of guys that you can kind of shuffle in any sort of order and have there be a valid argument for why they are where they are. So I think that, this is so volatile and in its infancy stages that, again, you can really shuffle this and move it around any which way you want, which makes it fun. And there were also a handful of guys that were tough to leave off, probably deserved to be on there, but at the end of the day got left off just by a hair. So it was a fun exercise to do. Certainly helped me gain more knowledge with the class itself and have a good feel for it going forward. And then looking to expand it to maybe 75 or so guys at the end of the season. Maybe the middle of the summer feels like a good checkpoint to do that at 75, because you get the end of the season. And then you've also got some summer wood bat performance to take into account. So maybe a reordering / update and expansion to 75 in the coming months.
That sounds good. One player that I'll just mention who I'm quietly really liking is, and maybe you know the pronunciation of his name, but PJ Mutsuraitis at California.
Nailed it.
Okay, great. Sounds good. He's been hitting well. He's a name that I heard from a scout early on this spring as a guy to just watch out for, because it sounded like he was a little bit under the radar as a high schooler coming out in last year's class, but he's been phenomenal for California. I'm really looking forward to watching him more. Just a name that I'm intrigued with. But definitely check out the full list that Peter has on the site. A lot of good work went into it. Peter, before we get out of here, anything you want to plug, anything you want to mention, what's coming up this weekend, et cetera, normal housekeeping stuff here.
Yeah, so just dropped the top 50 2026 guys over on the site. My weekly What to Watch For piece, which came out a few hours later than it normally does, thanks to a little bit of mashed potato brain on my end. But that's out now. And then I've got obviously the draft podcast every Friday with Carlos, and then college podcast every Thursday with Teddy. And then also Carlos and I do the hot sheet each Tuesday. And Teddy and I start the week off with a fresh new top 25, which, similar to the draft class, is as volatile as ever. There is so much movement up and down every week, new teams entering, teams falling out, teams re-entering. So that's made the college season a lot of fun to follow. And this weekend on the college side, it's not the most impressive slate of games. UVA and UNC sticks out as one series that I'm really excited for. And then another one that I'm probably most intrigued by is UC Santa Barbara, UC Irvine out west. Those are two of the best teams on the West Coast, and Saturday's game is nationally televised on ESPN2. So it'll be very easy for anyone who wants to tune in to watch that one.
Awesome. The one thing I'll plug is we also have the new BA Hot Sheet show on YouTube that is produced with the guys at Foul Territory that launched earlier this week. Very excited about that. Just finding new avenues to get you guys prospect content. If you're a big fan of the podcast and you really like just listening to us break down players, I imagine you'll like the Hot Sheet show as well. The production of that is just really fun to see. Again, thanks to the efforts of the Foul Territory guys for helping us put it on. That'll be a weekly show that comes out, I believe, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, live streamed on our YouTube channel at Baseball America. It'll also be turned into a podcast, so the same feed that you're listening on now, you probably have already seen it in the feed, but expect more of those in the future. And I think that's a project that we're all really excited for. I'll be on there. I imagine Peter will all be on there at times, but just a really cool new initiative from us over at BA. So check that out. And then, yeah, I think that's all I have. Check out everything Peter just mentioned. Thank you guys for hanging out with us, listening to the show, following along, subscribing to BA. We really, really appreciate it. And just have a blast getting to talk about baseball with you guys. So thanks. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you guys next time.